When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
I want to talk about another case here today. That, of course, Brian Koberger. Not the criminal aspect of this anymore, but I guess where it's naturally going now, civil. The Gonzalez family is now going after Washington State University, essentially saying you had the guy in your building, in your program, on your payroll, and you had warning after warning that something wasn't right and you didn't do enough. We've seen the police reports and the post-sentencing document dumps, more than a dozen formal complaints, women saying they felt trapped and unsafe. A professor warned that if WSU gave him a PhD, they'd end up reading about him stalking and abusing students. Now, the families are packaging all of that into a civil claim and asking a court to decide whether WSU dropped the ball in a way that the law actually recognizes. So I want to get into this with Eric Faddis, defense attorney and a former prosecutor, and look at the roadmap here. What evidence we really have, what a plaintiff's lawyer is going to have to prove, what WSU's defenses look like, and whether this is a long shot leverage play or a very real liability problem for the university. Eric, first off, from a prosecutor turned civil litigator lens, how do you see this when you hear that the Gonzalez family is pursuing a claim against Washington State University? What do you understand that to mean in practical terms here?
Sure. From a practical perspective, it absolutely makes sense because the Gonzalez family is trying to find some kind of solace, some kind of remedy within the civil court system. You know, the criminal system did not get the outcome they wanted. And so Koberger doesn't have any money. They can't go after him for millions of dollars. So they've got to look to some other entity with deep pockets, enter the university. And then what's going to be really critical is, what did the university know before this happened? And was the university negligent? And did that negligence, was it a substantial factor in causing what happened? These are all serious legal issues, and I think there are arguments on both sides.
What responsibility does an employer have to protect its employees? I mean, get down to the nitty-gritty here. If you've got multiple complaints about an employee, and Tony, you and I have worked in some places where we've had similar situations, not to this extreme, but there has to be some mechanism that kicks in that starts to protect the innocent people and take that perpetrator and say, enough is enough. What safeguards are there in our world for this?
Yeah, Stacey, you know, employers are in a bit of a difficult position because they have to take any complaints seriously, and ones that appear credible that they should investigate and they should report if appropriate. On the other hand, you know, they also kind of have maybe not a legal duty of loyalty to their employee, but perhaps they feel some sense that, hey, this person's kind of on our side, and we've got to ensure that these aren't just some false allegations, some false complaints, perhaps some impure motives or something by people who are coming forward. And so it's a delicate balance that they have to do, but ultimately they have a legal responsibility to make sure they're not negligent in addressing those complaints and that something horrible doesn't happen that could have been caused by their negligence. And so tough position for employers in that situation.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I mean, damned if you do, damned if you don't. We don't know all the details yet about exactly what is going to come out, but I'm very curious to see just how many complaints were filed, what the nature is of all of those complaints, how they were handled. I mean, it's going to come down to that, I think, probably more than anything, is it not? Of did they take these threats seriously, and did they act in a reasonable way? Reasonable being key.
100%. Reasonableness is really at the heart of negligence. You know, did they act like a reasonable entity would, or did they take action that was for which it was foreseeable that something horrible could have happened due to their omissions and their lack of investigation, that kind of thing? And Tony, you know, you talk about one complaint, you know, that's a thing and should be taken seriously. Two complaints, it's starting to escalate now. But when we start to have a multiplicity of complaints over a period of time that perhaps have a common threat, I think the employer really has a legal responsibility to investigate that and to take action to make sure they are not somehow complicit or culpable in something this person could do because they knew about it and they didn't take enough reasonable action to protect folks from this person and what they knew about him. That's going to be at the center of the case.
I guess when we look at this, and again, we don't know what all of those complaints were. We've seen, you know, bits and pieces of them here throughout the years. And they've all kind of pointed to the character that we understand Koberger to be. But none of them, I mean, unless I'm missing something and it's not coming to my mind at this moment, so correct me if I'm wrong, if somebody remembers something differently, none of them were like, oh my God, this guy is going to go commit a quadruple homicide. Or, oh my God, this guy is going to assault me later today or right now. It's all from everything we've seen. They were creepy. He was awkward. He didn't seem to know boundaries. He didn't seem to know what's appropriate at times. But we didn't really see anything that went beyond that. And look, there's weird, bizarre, creepy-esque people that come across creepy in our society, whether they intend to or not. I think Koberger is a different animal because we, hindsight, learned a hell of a lot more about what was behind that facade. But leading up to it, he wasn't making lamps out of people's, you know, thighs and things like that. He was pretty low key, maybe too quiet, maybe too low key. It's a very big ask to say to a university or any entity, how did you not see this? How did you not step in and stop something if there really wasn't a lot to stop? Being awkward, being socially awkward, not knowing, you know, where to stand, not realizing you're blocking people in a way, having awkward conversations, none of those are crimes. And none of those things are prosecutable. And in a lot of cases, they're not fireable either, because many will argue in many cases that person, and in many cases, the reality is the person who's acting so awkward has a form of autism and doesn't get those normal cues and are a lot of times harmless, but do come across awkward because they scare us, because we've seen just how far some of these things could go. Is this going to be a very tough fight going after them legally? Do you think this will ever make it to an actual courtroom, or just the mere thought of this and these accusations that are going to come out are going to make WSU say, here's a check, please go away, we'd rather not have this in the headlines for the next 5 years?
a few points. So a legal linchpin of this civil case against the university is going to be foreseeability, which is what you were just touching on. Was it foreseeable that the actions the university took after having this information would have caused this individual to go out and murder four people? Is that really foreseeable based on the information they had? That's questionable. On top of that, on sort of the flip side, that there is certainly a PR, an optics incentive for the university to not want to get too deep into mm-hmm. the woods on discovery, on exactly yeah. what the complaints were, on exactly what the university knew and exactly what they did. But lastly, another question is going to be, based on the information they had, did the university take reasonable measures? Because that's really their duty. And if so, the university is going to say, what did you want us to do? Call the police about something that's not a crime? Fire the guy and risk liability on our end? Did you want us to do like a national press release on so that everybody in the world or in the hears mm-hmm. the information we have? What reasonable measures did they want this university to take? And so I think it's going to get pretty messy, and the university has an incentive to try to kind of nip it in the bud, pay some money, and get out of it.
But hang on just a second. They have a criminology department that he's part of. They actually study this. It's not like he's working at an insurance company and he's some auditor and he's just crunching numbers and he's weird. He's actually in the criminology department. These are experts.
But they're not the administrators.
Correct. But do they have the power to go to the administrators and go, we study this stuff every day. We teach what we're seeing here. We are concerned about something. Do they have an extraordinary duty because of their expertise?
I think it's a creative argument that the plaintiffs might bring, Stacey, because in terms of deciding whether the entity acted reasonably, the inquiry is going to be whether an entity in the same or similar circumstances would have acted the same way. And so those circumstances could include specializations within that entity and information they had. And, if this was, a school that only did engineering, do they have, do the actions they take appear reasonable as compared to a school that actually does specialize in criminology stuff? Is there sort of a heightened burden and creative argument?
But here again, and you have conflicting viewpoints from various people who were interacting with him. On one hand, and this is just the knowledge that we know about this, Ramsland has come out. Catherine Ramsland has said, I didn't see anything weird with him. She was just as surprised as everybody else. I'm paraphrasing, but she has never come out and said, oh my gosh, yeah, red flags are this guy all the way. In fact, very much the opposite is the way she's expressed her thoughts of Brian Koberger. But then you also have an unnamed faculty member who in a meeting did say something to the effect of basically, if we keep this guy, if we give this guy a degree, if we graduate him and give him the title, we're going to see him in headlines. It's perspective, but I think the university on one hand can say, look, the person who's one of the foremost experts in the country, in the world, on serial killers and people like this, didn't see this coming. And they work for us. How the hell do you expect an administrator to have known more about this or have seen more of this coming? This is someone who, right dead on, didn't see it coming. Some people got icky vibes. Some people got weird vibes, and rightfully so. He was icky and weird. But again, doesn't make him a murderer at that moment in time and doesn't make anybody a predictor of the future. If you go out and interact with a bunch of autistic people and you have them all certified as none of them are offenders of any sort, none of them are doing all sorts of horrible shit on the side, they're just awkward, you're going to have plenty of people who will walk away from that experience going, I think this person does this, I think this person does that. And at the end, no, they're just autistic and they can't communicate the same way other people do.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point and a way that the university is going to buttress its defense, because my gosh, if this individual who is intimately familiar with criminology and murderers and that kind of thing, if it wasn't foreseeable to her, how is it foreseeable to some, you know, administrator who has no such specialization? I think that foreseeability piece is going to be big. I think that there's usually a doctrine in most states called an intervening actor event, whereby even if the university maybe should have handled it differently, was that the intervening act so material to the ultimate outcome that it means that the university was not responsible, that intervening act being Koberger slaughtering four people.
Yeah, I mean, I want to play this, all the angles of this. I mean, I want people to be responsible, especially schools and school districts and universities and all of that, that don't take predatory behavior seriously. I'm mm-hmm. big on that. And there's too much of what's called passing the trash where, and this is not applicable in this situation, but we see it a lot in elementary education and things of that, where you will have a teacher that has complaints in one district about something. The district doesn't want the attention. They don't want the bad PR. They have the person resign. And then that track record, there's no national database for this. Some states have them. Some states don't. Some follow them to a rule. Some have little loopholes here and there, and then that person just slyly and quietly moves on to their next job. Those sort of things need to be, you know, parsed out, as do when you have a series and a pattern of complaints in a university setting against a student, against a teacher, against a teaching assistant, as Koberger was. There needs to be a clearer path to resolving and dealing with these issues in a more concise, in a more timely manner. Eventually, they did get rid of him. I'm sure they're going to argue that, too, of like, look, we were in the process of doing all this. The ball was certainly rolling, but we had to meet certain benchmarks before we could do that. Maybe it's going to be a review of those processes, and there'll be less boxes to check before action can be taken. I think it's important that we look at this and look at who are the real boogeymen here. Is it really WSU? Is it more just Koberger? Is it the system as a whole? Is it what is wrong, or is there nothing wrong? And this is just really someone who was able to blend in and to be a chameleon until he decided he wasn't a chameleon no more.
I fully sympathize with the victims' families of trying to squeeze out some semblance of justice here and exploring every avenue they can. That being said, you know, I'm not sure it makes sense to demonize the university. I'm not saying that's what the family's doing, but if we got to the trial phase, there'd probably be some pretty unkind words regarding the university. What more could they have done? And I think that this intervening actor thing, that the fact that, hey, you know, the university would say, hey, this was Koper. You know, it wasn't the teacher at the university who went and you know, knifed four college students, one stayed away. This was the acts of a crazy psychopathic serial killer. He's the one who's responsible here. And you know, the university is kind of just being looped in on this. That's how defense will likely play it.
This is being filed as a tort claim. Right now, a lot of this is in the form of that and those notices. For people who aren't lawyers, Eric, what is the difference here between filing a tort claim and actually filing a full-blown lawsuit?
Different states use different nomenclature. A tort is typically just a civil wrong, and it usually means it's often associated with negligence. And in fact, the claim itself can be filed with the university and with the university's insurance carrier without a lawsuit being filed at all. The mm-hmm. lawsuit is sort of the final step. If you can't resolve the claim during the claims process with the insurance adjuster. And so there are multiple levels to bringing these sorts of allegations and trying to seek redress. And we certainly aren't at the trial phase in a lawsuit at this point. That would be mm-hmm. months or potentially years down the road.
And with something like this, whether this makes it to a actual trial or not, we have yet to see. Time will tell on that. when things like this happen and you have something like this coming to light, you have the family of these victims going after this university that employed him, not the same university that their kids were attending, keep in mind as well. Washington State is not Idaho State. They're different universities altogether. It was the one Koberger was actually teaching at, not the ones that their children were attending. But when you have things like this coming about, do we see change within universities or whatever setting it may be? Do they tend to go back when they're faced with legal repercussions, monetary repercussions, or insurance companies saying, we're not going to deal with this shit again? Do you think we're going to see some sort of change in policy at the very least, whether they end up paying out to the families or they're found guilty or innocent or whatever? At the end of the day, is this going to likely spark some sort of reform within the power structure there, within how they're handling things internally, so they don't run into this sort of a scenario again?
You know, it would certainly behoove the university to take subsequent remedial measures to try and ensure that this type of situation doesn't happen again, to the extent that they can do that. And I think that civil litigation can be a vehicle for that kind of change. You know, if the university and or its insurer is popped for a lot of money, not only can that change policies and procedures, but sometimes the underwriters, sometimes the insurance carriers who insure these massive entities like a university might put additional requirements now. They might say, hey, you know, in order for us to continue insuring you, you need to impose these additional requirements. You need to impose these additional conditions, these additional procedures if such an issue arises again. And so sometimes you can compel reform through civil litigation in, you know, kind of albeit in a convoluted way.
Mm-hmm. What do we got in the comments right now, Stacey? You know, there's a lot of questions about this situation.
Yeah, talking about, you know, if the whole faculty of, and this is from Nina Chandra, the whole faculty of the Criminal Justice Department knew something was different about him. They just couldn't find a viable solution to get him out of the program because he was at the top of his class. And that's something that makes it even harder. He was a good student. So what do you do?
You know, there are ethical considerations for universities. There are legal considerations for universities within that context. We can't have an environment in which, you know, someone acts a little different and all of a sudden we, you know, cast them out on the street or something like that. You know, we've got to be sort of nuanced in how we're viewing a person's behavior and how we're assessing potential complaints and that kind of thing. And so I think it's a tricky situation for these universities because there are mental health issues. There are psychological diagnoses like autism, bipolar, borderline personality. But there's a number of things that shouldn't preclude a person from employment unless there is a serious risk of danger. And so it's that unless part that I think we need to be vigilant about as well.
Jeff also says, reminds, and he's taking us back to the movie Office Space. I love this. Says, reminds me of the movie Office Space where the odd employee Milton, who under his breath says, I could burn this place down. Then that happens. Maybe it's about how clear the warning signs were. It's a good point.
Yeah, very much so. And sometimes it's really hard in the moment to have clarity on those things. You know, some person says, hey, this guy is being kind of creepy, I think. Well, does that mean, you know, we call the police? Does that mean we fire him on the spot? Does that mean we put him in some sort of program or required treatment? It's just very difficult in terms of what the university's response should be and what they really knew.
Another one that Jeff had, and I'm curious about it. Will the WSU case bring about testimony from previous employment of Brian Koberger's? I'm curious about that because we have seen others say, yep, he was employed here. We got nothing else to say. I'm wondering, I mean, would they have to be named in a suit or some sort for any of their history or records of him to come to light? Or could those sort of things be part of discovery in a case like this, if we ever get that far?
You know, the central inquiry is, what did Washington State University know, and mm-hmm. what action did they take, and not what former employers knew. However, I think that there's a way plaintiffs might angle this by saying, before you hire someone, you got to look into their background, don't you? You got to make sure you're not hiring some complete psychopath. And does that impose a duty upon the university to talk to former employers to say, hey, were there any complaints about this guy? Were there any allegations? Were there any problems you had with him? And through that avenue, we could see information from former employers.
Aren't employers' hands tied a bit with what they can disclose about previous employment? They can say, yes, they were fired, but they can't go into more detail? Or am I misunderstanding that?
You know, Stacey, my understanding is that state law varies considerably on that issue. So, you know, some state laws say, yeah, former employer can tell you whatever they want, whereas others, there are privacy considerations and yes. And including if there were internal investigations at former employers, those things can have privacy considerations that could prevent the disclosure of information that came out during those investigations. So, kind of it varies state by state, and it's kind of unclear right now.
Yeah, I think I'm in a state in Wisconsin where I don't think you can divulge a whole bunch of information. You can just say, we terminated this person, and then you're just left to fill in the blanks about why.
Although in a situation like this, when the person's behind bars for the rest of their lives, there's probably a little more, I would imagine, that could be shared at this point. I don't know that you're fearing a lawsuit, and because that would be traditionally why those sort of things would be in place and why they can't. In a normal situation, with the dynamics here, though, I think it does raise itself to a very different place. There was one more I want to address. Why do many Americans see dollar signs when a loved one dies? I don't think that is the motivation of the No. Gonsalves family here at all. I think there's maybe one or two things going on. I think one is, we're going to have to make you maybe look at your policies a little bit more and change it to do better so this doesn't happen to other people. And sometimes the only way to get institutional change is by putting pressure under them financially, unfortunately.
It's a mechanism.
Exactly. That's why I think they might be using this as a mechanism for that. I don't think they're looking necessarily at this as, hey, it's going to be a big payday for us. Do people abuse the system and things like that? Yeah, without a doubt. But is that what's going on here? No. I really do not think that that is the matter at hand. And we'll see. We'll see what happens if real meaningful change takes place. I know another comment after that said it's more so about exposing Koberger for who he is and who he was, since the system shut all that down really quick with the plea deal. And maybe that's the other part of it, too. Let the world see what the monster was. Don't just let him go hide in the cell for all of eternity. There are other levers that the Gonsalves family and anyone can really pull who's been directly affected by this, if they want to let the mask come off of Koberger even more than it already has. It's a fascinating discussion. We'll see where this goes and if there's more civil litigation in the future. But I imagine that's going to be the next step in this, with probably several entities, but we'll have to wait and see. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you for coming on and giving us your insight. Always so valuable. Thank you again.
Great to be with you.
And for the rest of us, for Todd, for Stacey, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.